in their class a special reward, such as a better grade, an early recess, or an extra star on their good behavior tally sheet, if the boys will not raise their hand more than once per class period. They find that some boys are so eager to talk and so boisterous in clamoring to be called on that their behavior disrupts the order of the classroom. High school teachers sometimes adopt the same practice with their adolescent boy students, particularly those who act up or talk out of turn in class. The teachers will let the boys leave early or take a short break from class if they demonstrate that they can keep quiet and behave. In other words, instead of trying to look behind the behavior to the real boy, to what is going on inside him, teachers assume a negative and ask these boys to make themselves even more invisible and to suppress their genuine selves further. Ironically, they're asking boys to act more like the old stereotype of the passive, feminine girl. The teachers may get what they want, a quiet classroom, but at what cost? Such approaches silence boys' voices of resistance and struggle and individuality, and serve to perpetuate boys' attention-seeking acts of irreverence. We need to develop a new code for real boys, gender-informed schools, and a more gender-savvy society where both boys and girls are drawn out to be themselves. If we want boys to become more empathic, we must be more empathic toward them. The Potency of Connection, a New Code for Boys and Girls. Growing up as a boy brings its own special difficulties, but the good news is that boys can and do overcome them when and if they feel connected to their families, friends, and communities. My research demonstrates that despite society's traumatizing pressure on boys to disconnect from their vulnerable inner selves, many, if not most, boys maintain an inner wellspring of emotional connectedness, a resilience that helps to sustain them. Sometimes these affective ties are formed with special male friends, boys' chumships. Boys may also forge empathic and meaningful friendships with girls and young women, relationships that are often platonic. The fact is that boys experience deep subliminal yearnings for connection, a hidden yearning for relationship that makes them long to be close to parents, teachers, coaches, friends, and family. Boys are full of love and empathy for others, and long to stay attached to their parents and closest mentors. These yearnings, in turn, can empower parents and professionals to become more deeply connected to the boys in their lives, much as Professor Carol Gilligan at Harvard and researchers at the Stone Center Group at Wellesley College have so eloquently advocated we do for girls. This intense power to connect of parents and others is part of the potency of connection that needs to be at the heart of a revised real boy code. Through the potency of connection, a boy can be helped to become himself, to grow into manhood in his own individual way, to be fully the real boy we know he is. Chapter 2. Stories of Shame and the Haunting Trauma of Separation. How We Can Connect with Boys and Change the Boy Code. It's really hard being a guy, 15-year-old Calvin Branford recently explained to me, because you're really expected not to talk about your feelings. You've got to deal with everything yourself. With girls, everybody expects they'll go off and talk to somebody. When you're a guy, you're really not allowed to do that. I guess it's pretty hard being a guy because there are so many things a normal person would probably do, but you're just not expected to. Johnny, the trauma of separation and shaming a boy. Johnny Martin was a boy of not quite 5 years of age who went for his first day in kindergarten. He was one of the smaller boys in the class. I spied him across a crowded room of 5- and 6-year-olds, all accompanied by their parents on this first day at a public primary school in a middle-class, educationally sophisticated suburb. The voice of the school principal came over the loudspeaker with a special greeting to all the new kindergarten students. He reminded them of the school's core principles: learning, respect for self and others, and diversity. Parents and children alike seemed too dazed and confused by this momentous occasion to take in much of this. My ears perked up when he said that all parents would be expected to leave at the 10-minute bell, but for today, and this day only, parents could stay with their kindergartners for 5 extra minutes to say goodbye. I guess that's when Johnny really came into view. He began to cling to his mother, and she, with great animation, was whispering something I could not hear. I understood from past painful experience that a child would do fine if he or she could let go of his mother at his own pace, be allowed to remain connected for as long as necessary each day, or until he was ready to make the developmental leap of separation on his own. Johnny was not so lucky. Surrounded by a group of 5 boys who couldn't wait to start playing with the trucks and crayons, Johnny stuck out like a sore thumb, a sensitive and still very young boy who wasn't ready quite yet to let go, who feared separation from his mother. When the bell rang, most of the parents drifted away, leaving only those who seemed to know from experience that their kids would need them to be there for a while longer, or some parents who probably just felt deep inside it was wrong to go quite yet. I asked the mother of another little boy, Sean, who was playing enthusiastically, but continuing to look over his shoulder to see if his mommy was still there, what she thought. "I don't know much about these things, but Sean just looks like he needs to be with me some more, so I'm staying," she said. Johnny's mother was more confused. She looked to Rachel, Johnny's teacher, who offered the traditional prescription: "A clean break and he'll be okay." The mother whispered to Johnny, "Now be a big boy, not like your crybaby little sister, and you'll be fine." With misty eyes, she kissed him on the head and started to leave. But before she reached the door, Johnny started to cry. His wailing could be heard all the way down the hall in the office of Mr. Bartlett, the school's principal. In a flash, he was on the scene and suggested that Ms. Friedland, the school nurse, get involved. Ms. Friedland, a woman in her late 50s, came and advised that Rachel would need to be stricter with the students. "You'll learn, Rachel, that setting a firm limit is the best thing, especially for boys." When Rachel asked, "Why boys?" Ms. Friedland delivered a perfect summary of the boy code. "Separation is hard for girls," she explained with authority, "since they're so close to their mothers. Boys, however, have to be more independent, or their peers will call them sissies and make fun of them. It's our job to help boys deal with this, especially if their mothers haven't done it themselves." She glanced at Johnny's mother. "You don't want Johnny to become overdependent, do you?" she asked. "Let's see if we can get him to handle things on his own." Now that the experts were involved, Johnny's mother was told that she could feel free to leave. Johnny was still crying, though less frantically, and as the nurse began to read him a story, Mom left. Later that week, when I had the chance to observe the classroom again, I asked Rachel how things were going. "Well, some parents wait to leave until their kids give them a signal that they're ready to be on their own," she explained. "Most of these kids have adjusted beautifully, and each day they let their parents go sooner. I wish I could say the same for all the other kids. Some of the boys, especially those who were so brave on the first day, spend a good deal of time crying for their mothers, and I have to comfort them, often in a group." "What about Johnny Martin?" I asked. "You'll see for yourself in a minute. I've got to get ready for the class." The bell rang, and almost all the parents scattered. Sean's mother was still staying behind, and now was enlisted in comforting some of the other boys who looked sad when their dads and moms left the room at 9:05. I heard what at first I thought to be a loud coughing noise in the corner, and when I turned around, I saw Johnny Martin, isolated from his classmates, on the side of the room, vomiting into a small waste paper basket. "What's the matter, Rachel?" I asked. "He's been doing that every day after his mother leaves, crying and throwing up." "What did the school nurse have to say?" "Well, Ms. Friedland thinks he's overattached to his mother, that if this disruption continues, he may need a special class or therapeutic counseling." As we spoke, Johnny kept vomiting, and the class fell silent, as if awed by the sight. There and then I broke a vow I had made to myself, never to give a teacher advice when I was only invited to observe his or her classroom. But Johnny was traumatized, and Rachel, a novice at her job, but empathic at heart, knew something was wrong. I explained that vomiting was a stage 2 response to unbearable separation, an escalation from the crying that had led to no adequate response, and that next might come a more dangerous withdrawal. Then the nurse and principal would have a self-fulfilling prophecy of a special needs boy on their hands. I told Rachel that all kids separate at their own rates, and that boys need not be pushed to separate more quickly than girls. At first I worried about the impact of my blunt comments, but Rachel's response reassured me. She breathed a sigh of relief, and when Ms. Friedland came to check in, Rachel told her that since the present plan wasn't working, and since it was her classroom, she would try a technique of her own. Johnny's mother would be invited back and would stay until her child felt more comfortable and less pressure to separate. A month later, I saw Rachel again. "Thanks for your advice," she said. "It worked wonderfully. Johnny's mother felt less guilty, Johnny seemed more self-assured, and after about 10 days, he let his mom leave without any fuss. Now, if I can only get up the courage as a second-year teacher to confront Mr. Bartlett and Ms. Friedland about this policy and the needs of the boys in my class, I'll be all set." The Boy Code, 4 Injunctions. Boys learn the Boy Code in sandboxes, playgrounds, schoolrooms, camps, churches, and hangouts, and are taught by peers, coaches, teachers, and just about everybody else. In the Listening to Boys' Voices study, even very young boys reported that they felt they must keep a stiff upper lip, not show their feelings, act real tough, not act too nice, be cool, just laugh and brush it off when someone punches you. These boys were not referring to subtle suggestions about how they might comport themselves. Rather, they were invoking strict rules they had absorbed about how they must behave, rules that most of them seemed to genuinely fear breaking. Relying on well-known research, Professors Deborah David and Robert Brannan divided these kinds of do-or-die rules or injunctions boys follow into four basic stereotyped male ideals or models of behavior. These four imperatives are at the heart of the boy code. The sturdy oak. Men should be stoic, stable, and independent. A man never shows weakness. Accordingly, boys are not to share pain or grieve openly. Boys are considered to have broken this guideline, for instance, if they whimper, cry, or complain, or sometimes even if they simply ask for an explanation in a confusing or frightening situation. As one boy in the Voices study put it, if somebody slugs you in the face, probably the best thing you could do is just smile and act like it didn't hurt. You definitely shouldn't cry or say anything. The sturdy oak requirement drains boys' energy because it calls upon them to perform a constant acting job, to pretend to be confident when they may feel afraid, sturdy when they may feel shaky, independent when they may be desperate for love, attention, and support. Give 'em hell. This is the stance of some of our sports coaches, of roles played by John Wayne, Clint Eastwood, and Bruce Lee. A stance based on false self, of extreme daring, bravado, and attraction to violence. This injunction stems largely from the myth that boys will be boys. More on such myths later. The misconception that somehow boys are biologically wired to act like macho, high-energy, even violent supermen. This is the boy code requirement that leads many boys to dare each other to engage in risky behaviors, and that causes some parents to simply shrug their shoulders if their sons injure themselves or others. The big wheel. This is the imperative men and boys feel to achieve status, dominance, and power. Or, understood another way, the big wheel refers to the way in which boys and men are taught to avoid shame at all costs, to wear the mask of coolness, to act as though everything is going all right, as though everything is under control, even if it isn't. This boy code imperative leads many boys and men to push themselves excessively at academic or career-related work, often in an effort to repress feelings of failure or unhappiness. No sissy stuff. Perhaps the most traumatizing and dangerous injunction thrust on boys and men is the literal gender straitjacket that prohibits boys from expressing feelings or urges seen, mistakenly, as feminine. Dependence, warmth, empathy. According to the ideal of no sissy stuff, such feelings and behaviors are taboo. Rather than being allowed to explore these emotional states and activities, boys are prematurely forced to shut them out, to become self-reliant. And when boys start to break under the strain, when nonetheless they display feminine feelings or behaviors, they are usually greeted not with empathy but with ridicule, with taunts and threats that shame them for their failure to act and feel in stereotypically masculine ways. And so, boys become determined never to act that way again. They bury those feelings. And so, in several fundamental ways, the boy code affects the ability of boys and adults to connect. First, it separates boys from their parents too early, before most boys are actually emotionally prepared for it. When boys encounter some of early childhood's most trying times, when they sleep alone in a crib for the first time, are sent away for 2 weeks of summer camp, or separate from their parents for the first day of kindergarten. They are often being pushed toward pseudo-independence before they're really ready. Yet, when boys rebel against this push to separate, when they cry, get injured, or tell friends that they'd rather stay at home than go outside and play, society's boy code makes them feel ashamed of themselves. Shame haunts many boys all their lives, undermining their core of self-confidence, eroding their fragile self-esteem, leaving them with profound feelings of loneliness, sadness, and disconnection. Moreover, it affects our ability to fully connect with our boys. Even when boys appear sad or afraid, our culture lets them know in no uncertain terms that they had better toughen up and tough it out by themselves. The feelings boys are forced to repress become so troubling that some boys may show the apparent symptoms of attention deficit disorder and serious conduct disorders, become depressed, and, when they're older, turn to alcohol or drugs. Indeed, the same kind of shame that silences adolescent girls from expressing their true voice affects boys at a much younger age, at the age of 5 or 6. But the good news, I also believe, is that neither boys nor the adults who care for them need to live by these rules. Boys can rebel against them and revise the code for boys and girls so that they can experience a broad range of feelings and behaviors. Parents do not have to resist their deepest feelings for their sons, or let myths about boys overwhelm the wisdom of their own instincts. Together we can unlearn the boy code. Together we can insist on enjoying close, emotionally rich relationships based on connection instead of disconnection. Roger, Boot Camp for Loneliness and Shame. Roger's mother sent him to a 3-week sleepaway summer camp program for the first time. "I guess I wasn't really thinking about how hard it might be for him to be away from me at age 7, his mother, Jay Waters, explained. "Later, when I thought more about it, I realized I would never have been ready for that at his age. I guess I thought a boy would like to have an independent adventure on his own. As a single parent, I was really looking forward to a few weeks to myself. I forgot that he is as attached to me as I was to my mother when I was 7 years old." Roger was miserable from the moment his mom dropped him off at the camp. "I didn't know anybody. I kept looking at my mom's picture, but it wasn't enough. I hated camp," Roger told me tearfully. Jay saved the heart-wrenching letter Roger mailed on his 3rd day there. "Dear Mom," it read, "I hate it here. The food makes me throw up. Nothing we do is fun. I am crying every day because I miss you so much. I think of you all the time. I know you love me, so please come get me right now. Love, your son." "I considered driving the 3 hours to get him that day, but I decided to wait until visiting day over the weekend. I wanted to make sure he wouldn't get used to it and start liking it after a few more days," Jay explained. "I tried to call on the phone, but the camp director explained it would be better to let him tough it out." Roger came back with her that Saturday. "I'll never know how damaging it was to him to be there for that whole week. I hoped that he got something out of it, but I'm afraid all he got was a lot of pain that probably nobody would have expected him to put up with if he were a girl. I realize some separations can be painful and are necessary for kids, but it was just too soon and nobody saw it, not even the supposed expert of a camp director. I don't ever want to go to camp again, Roger maintains. I'd rather just hang around here while my mom goes to work than go anyplace else. Premature separation, the trauma of boyhood. Both Roger Waters and Johnny Martin were suffering the trauma of premature separation, the source of much of their pain today. The disconnection they feel and their fear of being shamed. For all of society's mandates to boys to act like invulnerable superheroes, among all the subtle messages given to boys to downplay their sadness and pain, premature separation is the deepest hurt of all. At the heart of society's beliefs about boys are the ideas that early on boys need to achieve masculine autonomy, and that even today this is a prerequisite for a boy's healthy psychological development. Since young boys are taught that staying close to their mothers is something shameful, one of their natural responses is to turn to their fathers for love. Yet for some boys, mother may offer a special kind of nurturing, loving interaction that even the most caring father may not be able to replicate. And for many other boys, father may simply not be there to meet them. Fathers often work long hours, tend to leave parenting to the mother, or are not able to nurture their son's emotional development. Many fathers want to be there for their sons, but fear that doing so will only bring their sons further shame or distress. In a later chapter, I'll have more to say about the empathic relationships of fathers and sons. At a very young age, a boy may feel emotionally abandoned without knowing that's what he feels. Or he may know, as 11-year-old Jake described this part of his early childhood, I felt left out in the cold. I was all alone and just had to fend for myself. Or as 17-year-old Jamal explained, my dad always seemed jealous and would throw these real temper tantrums if my mom let me lean on her. So by the time I was 5, neither one of them acted like they really understood what I was going through, even if they really did. This painful separation process, by which many very young boys are shamed into withdrawing from their mothers more than they naturally want to, and then are only partially nurtured by their fathers, is a devastating disruption in a boy's emotional life. It is too often vigorously defended or even celebrated as a natural movement forward for the young boy, an inevitable step away from childlike dependency toward so-called healthy masculine identity. Yet many people who advocate this attitude toward boys believe it would be a tragedy if such a schism were to happen so early in a young girl's life. This relational rupture, this trauma, profoundly affects the psychology of most boys, and of most men, forever. To understand what it is like to experience this trauma, we needn't go any further than the trauma adults experience when their hearts are broken, the trauma of unrequited love. In my clinical practice, I have found that deep in the psyche of older boys and men lies the formative experience of a little boy struggling to maintain an early independent masculine sense of self. That little boy is not fending off too close a tie to mother, but rather is forever longing to return to her, and to the holding connection she once provided him, a connection he now feels he can never regain. If a boy had been allowed to separate at his own pace, that longing and sadness would not be there, or would be much less. Wishing to remain in mother's realm is normal. Although by kindergarten age many boys are already taking on the persona of their favorite super warrior, replete with space-age weapons and other high-tech equipment, Other boys of that age, and certainly many boys in preschool, are still in the corner playing with dolls and small trucks, and with the girls. For parents who ask me whether this is normal, I usually share with them research pioneered by New York psychoanalyst John Rawls. In a study in which he explored young boys' fantasies about pregnancy and birth, Rawls found that healthy boys, boys with a clear sense of masculine gender identity, still believed that, like their mothers, they could get pregnant, carry a child in their tummies, and give birth. This is not at all surprising when we stop to realize that the lion's share of child care for both girls and boys is given by mothers and female caregivers. And naturally, young boys identify with their earliest role models. So it is equally unremarkable to see a younger boy playing with a doll or even dressing up in mom's dress. But woe be unto him if this behavior continues beyond the age of 5 or 6. By the time boys are ready to enter school, they receive numerous messages in the media, from the toys they are given to play with, from older boys, parents, and teachers, that they must become different from their mothers in order to have a healthy male mentality. Toy manufacturers pour resources into creating boy toys, weapons and warriors and games of destruction. Schools still offer gender-specific activities, even when there is no valid reason for doing so. The cultural imperative to achieve this differentiation lies under the push towards separation. Nancy Chodorow, a feminist sociologist, did research that looked at how boys and girls connect with their mothers. She showed that because in our society women are still largely responsible for child care, boys appear to have a harder time than girls in integrating their identification as males, their initial gender identity. Girls can remain comfortably bonded with mother, she explained, but boys are threatened with a danger of remaining too close and not consolidating a safe enough sense of a different, more masculine self. Following from her argument, then, being a boy or being masculine is not so much based on the positive identification with father, but on the negation of the male child's tie to mother. Becoming masculine is defined as avoiding the feminine. Being a boy becomes defined in the negative, not being a girl. And this requires a more rigid separation from the close-touch world of mother and all things feminine or maternal, including warm, tender feelings such as vulnerability, empathy, and compassion. Some professionals still believe that this push for separation is good and necessary, that it provides a healthy way station in boys' growth toward manhood. This kind of separation is called disidentification, since the boy, by separating, is renouncing his earlier identification with mother and replacing it with a supposedly healthier male self-image now borrowed from his father. But in my opinion, this model of disidentification is not healthy, but damaging. If girls were emotionally separated from the caring people in their young lives and thrust into a world hostile to their dependency needs, we'd probably say these girls were in deep trouble, that they would fail unless they were rescued. Yet, when it is boys whose development we are contemplating, this ruptured connection is celebrated and is called a manifestation of health. Boys are alone. Let's imagine what this experience of ruptured connection must actually feel like for a little boy. Let's imagine the sense of loss a boy must feel as he is prodded to separate from the most cherished, admired, and loved person in his life, the shame and embarrassment he often encounters whenever he's asked to act like a man, but doesn't yet feel equipped to do so, the destructive feelings of self-hatred, inadequacy, loneliness, that become deeply embedded within the definition he creates of his own nascent masculine identity. A recent poll taken of children as young as 9 years old showed that only 40% of boys spent almost all weekend with their parents, as opposed to 50% of the girls. While not quite one-tenth of the girls sampled said they spent few or no hours with their families on the weekends, almost 25% of the young boys polled reported that they were already out on their own. Given the young age of many of the boys involved in this study, these statistics are staggering. They suggest that the schism between boys and their parents, most often thought of as taking place at adolescence, actually begins at a much earlier age. And the younger boys are when this separation is first thrust upon them, I believe, the more traumatic they may find the experience. Christopher, loneliness and sadness behind a young boy's mask. Sometimes a boy must undergo an unexpected and painful separation from his caregivers that is not related to a first day of school or time away at camp. Christopher Benson is a 10-year-old who came to see a colleague of mine. His parents were baffled as to how he could have become so depressed. An energetic, upbeat, extremely well-liked boy for most of his childhood, Christopher had undergone a year earlier a series of operations after a major bicycle accident had seriously injured his right foot. After the accident, Christopher had had to undergo months of medical treatments and physical therapy. He had missed weeks of school, and his whole family had rallied behind him to help him through the process. His parents couldn't figure out why only now, a year later, after Christopher had almost completely healed, he had suddenly become so depressed. According to his parents, Christopher had dealt with the accident and its aftermath with a positive attitude. He had rarely complained about the acute pain, never put up a fight when he had to undergo medical treatments, and had always joked about his condition with doctors, nurses, and family members. Everybody had loved Christopher. During his year of recovery, his parents had taken off a lot of time from work to be with him. For the months that Christopher was hospitalized, one of Christopher's parents had visited him in the afternoon every day, and many times one of them had spent the night with him at the hospital. About 11 months after the accident, Christopher had recovered almost 100% of the use of his right leg and was otherwise in top health. His doctors told him he could return to school on a full-time basis. His parents resumed their full-time work schedules, and Christopher went back to school. But instead of rejoicing in his recovery and slipping back cheerfully into his life at school and with his friends, Christopher became deeply depressed. He virtually stopped eating, became extremely quiet, and refused to cooperate with his parents or his teachers. He lost most of his energy, didn't respond when spoken to, and protested each morning when his parents tried to wake him up to send him off to school. For weeks, Christopher refused to say much of anything in his psychotherapy sessions. When asked how things were going for him, he either ignored my colleague or simply said that things were fine. But about 6 weeks into his therapy, Christopher finally opened up. When asked how his foot was doing, he stood up, kicked over his chair with his once injured foot, and shouted, "I wish it were broken again! I wish it were broken! I hate this!" "Tell me about what you hate. Do you hate having everything seem like it's okay when it really isn't?" my colleague asked him. Everything was okay when I was at the hospital, he explained, his words cut off by tears. But now everything sucks. I hate school. I hate everything. Have you spoken to your parents about this? They wouldn't care. They only cared about me when I was in the hospital. Now that I'm all better, they spend all their time with my little sister, Jessica. They hardly even talk to me. Then you miss having special times with your parents. Christopher responded by sobbing. In future sessions with Christopher, his parents were invited to come along. What emerged through these discussions was that once he returned from the hospital, Christopher still sought the extra attention his parents had given him when he was undergoing medical treatment. Christopher wanted to keep receiving the extra love, affection, and support they had given him when he was in the hospital. Although they loved him very much and wanted to see him happy, his parents were concerned about Christopher's apparent need for this kind of special attention. So instead of talking to him about it, instead of reassuring him about how much they loved and cared for him, they both nudged him away. They were, in effect, doing exactly as Johnny's mother and Roger's mother had done with their boys, forcing him to make a clean break and tough it out without adequate preparation or support. They both felt certain that if they continued to baby him, he would become overly dependent on them. "I didn't want to treat him like we treat his younger sister anymore," his father Chip explained, "because I felt that he should begin to learn how to handle things on his own. It was one thing when he was at the hospital, but once he had come home, I just didn't think he needed me or his mother to treat him like a little boy anymore. I really wanted to continue to take time off from work and spend it with Chris in the afternoons," his mother added. "But Chip convinced me that this would just make it harder for him to adjust to going back to school. I don't know. Maybe we were wrong not to stick in there longer for him." Christopher's parents were gentle, thoughtful people. They wanted what was best for Christopher. But what they were unable to do was feel comfortable staying emotionally connected to their son once an emergency had passed. Something made them feel that it was time to nudge this boy toward independence. This impulse, I believe, is normal in that many parents feel and act upon it. But as common as it may be, I believe that pushing boys to separate, to be on their own when they signal they need something else, is a mistake with serious emotional consequences. It is so traumatic that it can lead, as it did in the case of Christopher, to depression. Shame, the consequence of emotional disconnection. As boys reach adolescence, the traumas of early childhood can persist in forms that do not look like normal sadness or loss. So masked are boys' feelings by the teen years that many of the inexplicable bouts of anger or wild mood swings parents see may be produced in part by earlier, unrequited longings for connection and a fear of the shame such longings produce. Shame, it turns out, is with most of us throughout our lives. It begins to be experienced very early on, and is perhaps one of our most primitive feelings. Infants show the precursors to shame, physical responses, such as painful blushing and heat, when their vocalizations for parental response or gestures for recognition go largely unacknowledged. In some psychological research, shame is associated primarily with these types of early physical sensations. But I have come to believe, following Judy Jordan, my colleague at Harvard Medical School, that shame can also be described as the feeling state that accompanies an emotional disconnection. We all experience such emotional disconnection. Two common examples come to mind. The first one, suggested by a patient some years ago, involves what happens when we see somebody we know across a crowded street and wave to them. This is a simple reaching out for connection. But instead of returning the greeting, the other person stares in our direction, looks away, and keeps walking, as if to say, "Who the hell are you?" We realize he may not have seen us, but still we give a furtive glance to those around us. Do they see us looking foolish with our hand waving in the air? We blush and try to melt into the sidewalk. We don't want anybody to see us because we feel too embarrassed. The isolation and humiliation we feel, and the feelings of emotional disconnection that result, are what psychologists call shame. A second example involves the feelings of shame experienced in the workplace. You've created an important presentation for your manager. The key points of the presentation are rejected, however, and the boss derides them in front of your colleagues. You feel stupid, foolish. You want to disappear. You don't want anybody to exacerbate your feelings of vulnerability, so you shun any help. Instead, you turn inward and become emotionally disconnected from others. These examples are mild in comparison to what a boy experiences when he does not measure up to the boy code. But they help demonstrate what shame is all about. It is about feeling such a fear of humiliation and embarrassment that we prefer to be alone with our pain. Girls are sensitive to shame, but boys fear it. Because shame is such an undesirable experience, I have found that most boys and men will do anything to avoid the possibility of experiencing it. I recall attending a Little League game where my friend's son, Peter, was participating in one of his first baseball games. Before the second inning, Peter was hit in the head by his first hard ball. Small for his age, and only in the first grade, he looked absolutely mortified. The helmet drooping over his brow gave him the look of a miniature punch-drunk fighter about to go down for the count. His mother rushed out to the field to comfort her son. "Not here, Mom," she later told me he had whispered to her, stifling his tears. "Big guys don't cry on the field." For many years, traditional psychologists thought that exquisite sensitivity to shame was mostly characteristic of girls, especially at somewhat older ages. But what I have found after years of working with boys and their families is that the same kind of shame that silences girls from expressing their true voice as adolescents takes its inhibiting and self-suppressing toll on their brothers at a much earlier age. And while girls may be shame-sensitive, boys are shame-phobic. They are exquisitely yet unconsciously attuned to any signal of loss of face and will do just about whatever it takes to avoid shame. Rather than expose themselves to this kind of potent embarrassment, boys, in the face of suffering shame, engage in a variety of behaviors that range from avoidance of dependency to impulsive action, from bravado and rage-filled outbursts to intense violence. Gabe, trying to be the sturdy oak in a frightening forest. Boys can feel separation and disconnection and a resulting shame from an isolated experience as well as from a more prolonged separation such as going off to kindergarten. Gabe, 16, was usually a thoughtful boy, bright and cheerful. But this morning he was fidgeting in his chair like a much younger child, reminding me of a little kindergarten boy sitting still with difficulty in the classroom. Gabe's parents had brought him in to see me this time because of a sudden outburst of irritable and tearful behavior. All they had done was mention the idea of a tennis camp in a distant city. Gabe had good friendships and excellent grades, no prior history of emotional or behavioral problems, and he had mentioned getting serious about his tennis. So why such a radical response, a change from his usual cool composure? Gabe was as puzzled as everyone else. I thought about some indirect ways to find out what was on his mind, and remembered we had previously discussed dreams. But he had said he usually couldn't remember them. Today, however, Gabe could remember one from the previous night. "It was very scary. A nightmare, I think," he said. "A strange place, all dark and quiet, maybe in the woods. I felt all alone, but there were others there, my parents, I think. We were camping. All of us were in sleeping bags, but mine was missing. All of a sudden there was a noise at the edge of the tent, a wild animal maybe. I freaked, then I screamed, and that's when I woke up." The vividness with which he told the dream, the liveliness of his feelings in comparison to his day-to-day cool attitude, gave me a hunch that perhaps this dream was more than a complex piece of fantasy from Gabe's unconscious. Here, instead, was a memory emerging from repression. "Gabe," I asked, "does the dream remind you of anything similar that ever happened to you? Perhaps not recently, but long ago?" "No." Gabe paused. "Well," he started again, "I guess the only thing that comes to mind is that first camping trip in the Adirondacks, the summer I was 5. It was my first time away from home, my first time in a tent, but my whole family was with me, I remember now. The door of the tent was mosquito netting, and whoever slept next to it had to contend with cold drafts, the buzzing of mosquitoes, and the sounds of animals out in the woods. They sounded like wolves and bats. On our first night, my father slept next to the door, but on the second night, my father said that I should sleep next to the door. I should stand guard and protect the family from intruders. I didn't want to. I complained. But they told me I should be the big boy of the family and tough it out. I tried to tough it out, but then I heard a noise. I thought it was a bear or something, and I got very upset and started to cry. Dad told me not to be such a wimp and act like a man. I think he even told me a story about him and his dad roughing it in the woods." "Were you afraid?" I asked. "I guess it was actually pretty safe, or they wouldn't have let me stay out there all alone. But I remember being scared to death for days afterward. A funny thing, though, my mom told me that after that trip, I stopped begging her and Dad at bedtime to stay in my room with me. And my dad told her he thought I really had grown from the camping experience. Jesus, I must have been scared shitless and pushed it all away until now." Gabe revisited how parents can help ease the pain of separation. Gabe's dream and the memory the dream evoked are significant in that they reveal a boy who was afraid but was embarrassed to show he had been made to feel ashamed of his feelings at such a young age. While most boys may not have any such clear-cut nightmares nor horrifying memories of camping trips to report, many of them, like Gabe, may harbor unconscious memories of premature separation, of being pushed in a shameful, unexpected way towards pseudo-independence. All 3 to 5-year-olds suffer somewhat as they begin to spend more time apart from their primary caregiver. But society's gender stereotypes permit daughters to linger with their mothers while little boys are urged out of their comfort zones and into a premature separation. When the little boys resist, another set of stereotypes, that boys need to be toughened up leaves them with an additional burden of inner shame. As they grow up and face later challenges to their self-reliance or self-confidence, boys only allow these repressed emotions of early childhood to surface symbolically, as Gabe did when he reported his dream, or symptomatically, as Gabe did when he began to act unusually irritable and tearful, when his feelings of fear, frustration, and sadness became so overwhelming that they punctured his outer psychological armoring. But in most cases, boys hide these feelings behind their masks of cool. And as boys grow into men, they continue to hide their feelings, and an ever-intensifying sense of shame and disconnection develops within them. Acting out. Is it attention deficit disorder or loss of connection? For Johnny, Christopher, and Gabe, dealing with the trauma of separation and with the intense shame they felt about the feelings it produced meant turning inward, trying to handle their problems quietly and alone. Yet in many cases, boys deal with the pain of separating from their parents and the shame they feel by acting out, by using dramatic or disorderly conduct to call for help. I believe that an overwhelming number of elementary school boys diagnosed with conduct disorders or with what is often called attention deficit disorder or ADD are misbehaving not because they have a biological imbalance or deficit, but because they are seeking attention to replace the void left by their mothers and fathers. Their problems paying attention or regulating impulses may not be faulty wiring or testosterone poisoning, but simply the result of accumulated emotional wounds and years of paralyzing shame. These desperate last-ditch efforts to assuage the pain or resist the thrust of premature autonomy are frequently misread as symptoms of an illness rather than as a natural part of coping with the trauma of separation. When boys act rambunctious and their activities spiral into aggressiveness and violence, what they are often expressing is far from some sort of macho desire for power or vindication, but rather a longing to be nurtured, listened to, and understood, to engage in all of the needy, dependent behaviors they're being told are girl-like and forbidden. Certainly, there are boys with significant psychological disorders in need of appropriate diagnosis and treatment. Attention deficit disorder is a real illness, actually a constellation of psychological syndromes housed under one name. In fact, in 1995, more than 5 million children were classified as learning disabled, 25% greater than a decade ago. Within these categories of disability, ADD is the fastest-growing illness, with numbers doubling over the last 5 years. Perhaps most shocking, the ratio of boys to girls of such newly diagnosed ADD cases can range as high as 10 to 1. But when millions of boys are diagnosed as having attention deficit disorder, and when far fewer girls are given the same diagnosis, I begin to wonder whether this diagnosis is sometimes being applied inappropriately to what are normal episodes of boy behavior. I also wonder whether diagnosing boys as having this disorder reflects society's tendency to misunderstand how the trauma of separation affects school-age boys. The diagnosis of hyperactivity is often made on the basis of a checklist of behaviors that, in reality, could reflect boys' grief over losing emotional connection, a loss that we have learned cannot be fully expressed or mourned, but rather expresses itself through action or anger. In short, a combination of biologically influenced boy temperament, plus a boy's resistance to the boy code, may lead to a diagnosis of ADD. Rusty. Setting the World on Fire. Rusty was my first fire setter. Children who start fires frighten psychologists even more than extremely violent children, because the impulse is poorly understood and may lead to serious harm to large numbers of people. But this didn't seem to jibe with little Rusty's sad eyes, meek demeanor, and sudden outbursts of tearfulness when he was confronted with his crime. Sent to a locked psychiatric unit after he had induced two older boys to pour some lighter fluid on a pile of old wood behind his housing project and to light a fire, Rusty, age 7, did not deny his actions. He didn't show remorse, either. Rather, Rusty seemed to be in a dreamlike state, disconnected from the seriousness of the events. People began to throw around diagnoses and suggestions for treatment, and it was determined that Rusty's conduct disorders could involve ADD as well. Rusty's parents were of little help, as his mother felt that Rusty was too clingy, being the baby of the family, so she had pushed him to spend more time at school and Little League. Rusty's father had divorced his mother when Rusty was 5, and he rarely, if ever, visited. I made a request that we bring Rusty together in one room with his mother and father and talk about this boy's pain. Arranging the meeting wasn't easy, but it did finally take place. As might be expected, Rusty clung to his mother as soon as she entered, with her gently trying to redirect his attention. Then his father arrived. Rusty's whole face appeared to change in structure. He beamed as he ran to embrace his father. Rusty's dad was wearing some kind of badge. No surprise, as we had been told he worked as an investigator for the police department. All of a sudden, I got one of those hunches you just can't easily explain. "Mr. McDonald, what kind of work do you do exactly?" I asked. "Didn't Rusty tell you?" he replied. "I investigate fires of suspicious origin for the city." "Gee, I'm surprised Rusty didn't talk about it. I'd often take him along when he was a small boy. I think it fascinated him." No victim of ADD, no veteran fire setter, Rusty was a sad little boy who had lost his emotional bonds with mother and father and was calling out through conduct and action, typical boy approaches, for love and response. Luckily, most boys diagnosed with conduct or activity disorders don't light fires, but perhaps by acting out, these boys are attempting, through the language of behavior, to light a fire under us, to give us a wake-up call to their pain and desperation, feelings that will not be cured with medications or behavior modification. The slow poison of premature separation, boys and men still longing for connection. As the boys' voices I've shared reflect, the trauma of separation manifests itself in myriad ways. In many cases, the loss boys feel causes them to experience diminished or rocky self-esteem. They may become unhappy and disaffected, much in the way that Gabe did. In some cases, they may actually become clinically depressed, as Christopher did. Sometimes they may manifest psychosomatic diseases, such as the vomiting and crying spells that little Johnny endured. And sometimes, like Rusty, they may seek reconnection by acting out, behavior that may lead us, in the first instance, to diagnose them as hyperactive or as having attention deficit disorder. But perhaps most often, boys give the impression that everything is going just fine by effectively hiding behind the mask of an invulnerable personality. For years, they may suppress the angst they feel. And in many cases, boys become so skilled at pushing this trauma out of their memories that it is not until years later as adults that they remember what they went through. Many of the adult male patients I see still grapple with the aftermath of the trauma of separation. Many men still unconsciously long for connection with mother and the nurturing, holding environment she once provided. For example, when Paul, a 35-year-old man, recently lost his mother to cancer, he told me that even though he hadn't felt dependent on his mother as an adult, his mother's death made him feel terrible about himself. His mother, who lived in Italy, where Paul was born, had never received a college education and in many ways was not a central figure in Paul's daily life as an adult. Despite all this, Paul reported a sense of incredible loss. "I feel as though my only anchor in life is gone," he told me, explaining that after his mother's death, he had lost the energy to make love with his wife and felt little motivation to go to work. As we spent more time talking, it emerged that the pain Paul felt was linked less to any recent experiences he had had with his mother than to his memories of how she had nurtured him as a very young child. The warm, loving environment she had once created for him was now forever beyond his reach. As I discussed with Paul what I had learned about the trauma of separation and how this trauma continued to affect boys and men throughout their lives, Paul said, "Dr. Pollack, you just hit the nail on the head. I can't believe this. I've actually been dealing with these problems for years and only now realize how much it had to do with my mother. I forgot how painful it was when my father first separated me from her to send me off to school. I never would have thought any of that could still matter now." While Paul's response to the trauma of separation was to feel a lack of sexual drive and to experience the early symptoms of depression, other adult patients of mine have experienced far more severe responses. For example, David, a 40-year-old client of mine, was hospitalized when, after years of normal mental health, he attempted to commit suicide by consuming sedatives and an entire bottle of aspirin. As we worked together in therapy sessions, David recounted the acute pain he felt when Helen, his live-in girlfriend of 3 years, decided she couldn't take him anymore. David described how in all his relationships with women, he inevitably reached a point where he felt something was missing. "There's always at least one thing about each girlfriend," he explained, "that just really gets in my way of continuing the relationship." "Was it you who initiated breaking up with Helen?" I asked. "No," he whispered, his voice beginning to crack. "And for the first time, it wasn't me. Helen left me, and I don't know how I'll live without her." As our sessions progressed, David shared details about his relationships with women and what went wrong in each relationship. "Each of these friendships ended," he confessed, "because he always found at least one critically important trait missing in the women he dated. One woman he found too independent and self-absorbed. Another was somewhat guarded in the affection she gave David. And with Helen, he felt, she just wasn't as interested in starting a family as David was. She wanted at most one child, while he hoped to have many." As we pieced together the qualities David found missing in these relationships, he himself realized that the qualities he was seeking were in fact those he associated with his idealized mother. "In some ways," he explained, I always hold up my girlfriends to the image I have of my mother, and they just never seem to hit the mark. As I began to explain to David the trauma of separation and how the wound it leaves can affect us throughout our lives, he injected angrily, "I'm not interested in marrying my mother. I just want to be with somebody who will be as warm, caring,